Welcome to Middle School Matters Podcast 479. Ditch that empire. We've got some jokes. We've got some references to, well, ditching the empire. And some other resources for your classroom this week. So, without further ado, here's the wonderful, the magnanimous, the Mr. Troy Patterson.
All right, welcome back to the show. I am Troy Patterson, and with me is the world's greatest kosher host, Mr. Sean McGurr. Hey, Sean.
Well, hello there.
Oscar decided to make an appearance right as we start the show. So
on cue, too.
Yeah, on cue. No cue. It's on a whole different level. Literally, it's on a different floor. So, hey, you know, I started doing some simple origami, and now I'm into much more complex pieces.
Yeah.
Yeah, you could say it's a tenfold increase.
Ooh.
I went to get a library. I went to the library to get a book on the fall of the Roman Empire.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Turns out there are absolutely no pictures of autumn foliage in there.
Huh. Go figure.
Fall, Roman Empire, the fall. Yeah. Let's see now. Here's a question for you. Circumnavigating the globe. Is that a one-way trip or a round trip?
Yes. Yes, that's a good question.
Yes. Yeah. I would do that as a like a poll in Moodle. I would throw it in there as a little side poll and have the kids discuss and defend their answer and all that good stuff. But
I think that's an advisory thing for Monday for
me. Just a joke right there. So, you know what the difference is between a politician and an electrician?
No. Tell me the difference.
An electrician will never go for a power grab. You know, I'm not very active on social media. Seems like people are always aggressively trying to grab eyeballs. That sounds pretty messy and painful. I have some friends who are programmers who have started a new Beatles-inspired band. They have a new song. It's all about a long, convoluted program. Mm. It's called The Long and Winding Code. The Long and Winding Code. You know, there are some new jobs available right now. I have a friend who just got hired during the pandemic to make sure that those who enter the school building do not have a fever.
Mm.
Yeah. It's temp work.
Sure it is. I like it.
Hey, you know what's not temp work? Is
tell me.
Equity for all. And especially equity for all in terms of science.
Oh.
You know, I just can't say enough about Dave Bidlowski. And once again, he has a phenomenal, episode. So here, without further ado, is the wonderful Mr. Dave Bidlowski and the Middle School Science Minute.
Hi, this is Dave Bidlowski of K12Science.net, and this is your Middle School Science Minute. I was recently reading the Science Teacher magazine, a publication of the National Science Teaching Association, and I was reading the notes from the field editor, and that is Ann Haley McKenzie, and she wrote an article entitled Equity for All. And she wrote that under the microscope, the cell being observed does not care who is observing it. Woman, man, African American, Latino, Asian, middle class, hearing challenge, gay, Native American. Why has the scientific playing field not been equal for all? How can we, as science educators, erase inequitable practices in our teaching? A common misconception exists that equity and equality refer to the same thing. Equity is the proportional representation by race, gender, class, etc., with all opportunities. Equality is ensuring everyone is treated the same and giving everyone access to the same opportunities, rights, and resources in whatever endeavor is being pursued. Generally, students of poverty do not come to school on an equal footing. They need more resources in order to improve reading and math skills and to experience science to begin to close the achievement gap. By leveling the playing field, equality can be achieved. Equity provides more to those who need it. Schools that emphasize equity understand their students' needs and provide resources to overcome their specific challenges. Think of equity in terms of being adaptable, individual-focused, and fair. Vertical equity should be the goal for schools. This form of equity assumes that students have different needs and provides individual resources based on said needs. During the COVID-19 pandemic, while students learn from home, an example of vertical equity would be to ensure that all students have an electronic tablet and internet access at home. Equality would just mean that all students have a tablet. Equity in STEM career fields is a long-standing issue. As of 2015, African Americans represented 4.8% of the workforce in STEM, while Caucasians represented 66.6%. In 1993, African Americans represented a mere 3.6%. This increase represents only 1.2% in 25 years. The statistics for Latinos are equally dismal. According to the National Council for Minorities in Engineering, Latinos accounted for only 6.3% of the engineering degrees awarded in 2010 and a tiny 1.2% of those awarded doctoral degrees. Why aren't these voices present in the scientific community? What can we as science teachers do to encourage all students to pursue or at least consider STEM careers? African American and Latino students enter school scoring below Caucasian students in reading and math assessments. As they matriculate through school, these differences persist. They are less likely to enroll in AP courses, participate in STEM-related extracurricular activities, and take fewer math and science courses. Do they feel welcome and wanted in these courses? Are they counseled to enroll in more math and science classes? How can we help them get caught up to their communities who are succeeding in school? Lower socioeconomic status can pressure students to enter the workforce and forego higher education. We must provide resources, role models, mentors, and encouragement to these students and their families if we expect them to be on an equal playing field. How many Latino scientists can you name, and what contributions to science did they make? What African American scientists can you name, as well as their contributions? Do you include these voices in your science classroom? Do you do more than hang posters of women in science? Do you only mention African American scientists during February's Black History Month? If so, consider broadening your approach so that every student benefits from the stories of these accomplished STEM professionals. The time for a more diverse conversation to be present in the scientific community is now. We, as science educators, must insist on being an integral part of the conversation by providing an equitable science experience for all of our students. And this has been your Middle School Science Minute.
So, you know, he talks about equity, and I think equity is an important issue for all of us now, and especially with all of the remote learning, I'm hearing lots of discussions about equity and how all of that's playing out. So, but don't worry, we'll have the teachers do it.
That's right. If I hear that phrase one more time, there will be violence. I think so. Pretty sure.
Are you saying that there are extra things being put on teachers' plates without things being removed from teachers' plates?
Pretty much across the board. I mean, I'm speaking broad, in very broad terms. We're hearing that, and to be very honest, what it is it's there is a lot to do, and so stuff naturally has to be passed down to, right? So I think maybe as teachers, we also be conscious that we don't take that and pass it down to our students. You know, I got else to do. You're going to do this part of it, which is very easy to do.
Yeah, and I did see, I think it was the tatted teacher on Twitter who had posted, "Happy Saturday. How many hours are you working today?" to teach.
I came this close to putting a post on Facebook that said, and making my list of things to do this weekend, and then at the end saying, I'll see you Monday. Well, no, I won't see you Monday, but I won't see you next weekend either.
Yeah. So I think that we're seeing that from around is, and you know, there's a lot of changes. There's tons and tons of changes. And teachers are being asked to do different things, and they're being asked to do things that take learning, and learning takes time. And in many cases, they're being asked to offer alternatives, which also take additional time. And I mean, that's just reality. The reality is this: doing different things is tough. It is very, very difficult. So there's a lot of time in there, and although I haven't said that very often personally, mm-hmm. I can see where that comes from, and just judging from the people and teachers that I get to talk to from around, or again, around the state, around the country, and that it's just, it is much, there's a lot of stress all over, everywhere.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, a lot of conversations I had this week are mostly, so like, I have an informal temperature scale that I use throughout the year, right? And when I talk to my rookie teachers about this, I go, look, I got this unscientific thing going, but so far it's worked great for me. Let me share it with you. And then by the end of the first year, they're like, oh, my word, I see it. I said, okay, well, I'm not the only one. So usually at the beginning of the year, you got to stress in the first few weeks because it's the beginning of the year, right? But the stress level is to a certain point. Mm-hmm. And then it kind of eases down as you get into the routine of the year. And you can teach, right? And then you get to the point where it's right before Thanksgiving, and teacher stress levels are kind of ramping up, you know, towards that holiday. But that Thanksgiving gives them that little break to kind of step back and go, you know.
Yeah.
And then you have the run into Christmas break, and that's usually pretty steady and pretty easy, and that's a constant stress level that people are able to manage. And then after Christmas break into going into that run up to Easter, you can see the stress level rise up as you head into that. And then Easter gives them that little break to kind of just like take a breath. And then from there, it's almost, it's not a curve. It's almost an angular line that goes up towards, as you get towards June, where the stress levels get too insane. Mm-hmm. And I'm seeing in just my informal, this is my experience only, you know, and with teachers around the state, we're not talking about my building alone. You know, I'm seeing that in teachers and administrators, that the stress level is far higher
right
at this point than it is in any time that I've, you know, in the 20 some years I've been working as a teacher. We're seeing stress. I'm seeing stress levels from teachers that are up in the May zone, April, May zone. And that's
the May zone.
The May zone, right. You know, and for a reference point, you know, it's where teachers are ready to go after each other zone.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm thinking, this is way too early to have that kind of stress going on with teachers. And that carries over to the kids, too.
But that is a very real, real thing at this mm-hmm. point from what I'm seeing. And it is one of those things where I think it is an issue that people need to take care of themselves. They need to be cognizant of this. And they need to take care of themselves, because that is happening. People are getting extremely stressed. And I would posit that it's not just the teachers either. I think there's a lot of parents and students who are in the same situation, and we need to be aware of that as well. So.
And then I think there's an interesting corollary with that, in that we were talking earlier about books and book studies, and I don't know if you did put it in there, and I'll just kind of preface this. One of the book studies, or the books you mentioned this being used for a book study, in pre-publication right now, you can pre-order this book. It's a parental corollary for the teacher book. There's a parental version of it coming out. You can pre-order it. It's $20. I don't know if you buy at $20. I don't know how many of these books you would buy to give to parents. But I think, you know, the market is always responsive to needs, right? And they're hearing from parents that we're stressed out about this too. And of course, there's always the memes that are out there on social media about, there's a direct correlation between schooling the kids at home and alcohol consumption. It tends to be a positive corollary. So, at least in the memes. So,
yeah, and one of the things that I think comes into play there is availability. Because you had said something in our pre-show discussion where, a parent had reached out to you at 10:30 at night. And the question becomes, how quickly do you respond? How quickly do you have to respond?
Right.
I can only speak for me personally. I've heard from a couple of other people as well. The amount of email that is being received has ratcheted up.
Yes.
And it's become to the point where, for a few people, it's like, if all you did all day long was answer email, you could probably keep up with it. But if you're actually doing work as well, if you're actually, addressing some of the things that come in through an email and replying thoughtfully, then you can't keep up with the number of emails. And email is our lingua franca. It's the common communication tool for everything, right? It's the one thing that people have glommed on as universal. If I want to touch base with somebody, I'll email them. To the point where people will email and say, "Are you available for a phone call?" which indicates that somebody is expecting you to be paying attention to email, right? So,
right.
So it comes down to part of this comes down to availability. Should you be replying to email at 10:30 at night? Is that something that's healthy at this point as well?
And a number of teachers that I know have had serious discussions with them about it. And obviously it's an individual choice. I will say the district I work in has said, look, we're going to show you a neat little feature here in email. Click this button and it'll silence your email for, however many hours, you want it off. And then you click the button and it'll come back on. And so, all the emails will automatically go into your email box, but it'll do an autoresponder that says, hey, look, I'm off the clock. I'm spending time with family. I am recharging my batteries. I'm doing something to get ready for the next day. I'm not going to get to your email tonight. I will get it tomorrow when I get back to work. And I totally respect that. And I've gotten that where I've sent an email to a colleague and I've gotten the responder back that says, yeah, no, dude, no, not right now. And it's something that they'd asked for or something like that. I'm like, no, I'm not trying to bug you. But I totally get what they're coming from. I've taken kind of a different approach. I've been kind of a wait and see. I want to see how much email I actually get. And I haven't gotten a whole lot at the ungodly hour. of, you know, after whatever. I've gotten a few, but you know what? Here's my fear. My fear is that I'm going to have a parent come along and go, these teachers are not responsive. And, you know, it's going to be a reflection. That's the thing that's going to go out into the community. And everybody's going to say, well, you know, they don't look at that experience. They're not going to. And so I hit it back as fast as I can. It's like, you emailed me, boom, I'm going to respond as fast as I can right now. Because then they can't come along and go, you know, you don't listen. No, that's not true. I do listen. And I respond. Chances are good you never respond to me. But that's okay. It's a one-way street. I get that.
Yeah. And as far as availability, I also think it's interesting as to when are kids doing work and when are teachers doing work.
Right. Because no, I think there's a direct correlation there. You're right.
Because, you know, there's you have your night owls, and there's a lot of teachers that are night owls. And it comes down to, does it matter when work is done? You know, obviously, if it's synchronous, I think everybody's getting tired of synchronous and asynchronous, by the way. If it's synchronous, then yeah, sure, you got to be there at a certain time. But if it's asynchronous, does it matter? And you know, I think there's a lot of things to navigate at this point. You know, how many hours are being worked? Because we're very much still time based, right? We still expect kids to. The government, the at least for most state governments that I know of, they count seat time, right? You yep. have to have yep. X number of hours of seat time. And quite frankly, you know, a lot of employees are expected to work a 40-hour week. That's still kind of the standard. Okay, some of us are moving way beyond 40 hours and expected to work way beyond 40 hours, and that's... you know, just a thing that's always been as well. But it's the idea of a certain amount of time, right, that you go through. And so does it matter at what time you work those hours? You know, if you're a night owl and you want to work from 8 o'clock to midnight and get 4 hours in that way and then do the other 4 hours, you know, somewhere else, is that okay? Or... should that be expected or what? And that leads into, okay, so if I'm doing my 8 hours, I do it from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. so that I do the cover the synchronous times and that, blah, blah, blah. And then I work from, what did I say, from 8 o'clock to midnight at night. Then am I responsible for responding to that 3 p.m. email before 9 o'clock at night kind of thing, you know? So it leads into some interesting conversations and some interesting thought experiments about what is work, what is school. And I think we've seen a lot of kids are doing their work not at normal, quote unquote, school times. Right. Mm-hmm. The amount of kids doing work at 7:30 in the morning, I'm going to posit, is a little bit lower than when we require their physical attendance in school at 7:30 in the morning. So, I just thought the idea of availability and what time people are working is kind of interesting. So.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
And Moodle is really nice because you get to see what time they actually spend on the assignment and what time they turn it in. Mm-hmm. And so between 1 and 3 in the morning seems to be a very popular choice for my 7th and 8th graders. And so I'm not going to be up necessarily that late, but I do want to stay up long enough that I can help those kids who have questions right away. And they've been appreciative of it. But the 1 to 3 thing seems to be our popular time based, well, for my classes that I've seen.
Right.
Which explains why they're totally exhausted for a 7:30 advisory class.
Yes. They've only been sleeping for a couple. They took a little nap for a couple hours. They didn't actually sleep. So
that's right.
Yeah. So one of the things that also needs to be available is the testing. And I know Michigan and around this, I know in Michigan particularly, but I think around the country, the NWEA test is a pretty big concern. And a lot of places are doing the NWEA test online this year.
Yeah.
Which has led to some interesting things. Fortunately, some other people have gone first and have provided us with some tips on settings and how to make things work, like a reset the resolution of the Chromebook, because apparently the kids change the resolution of Chromebooks pretty regularly, and if it's not set to the right resolution, NWEA test is a problem. So, you know, we were able to share that with our teachers because others had gone kind of first. But then there's other issues. You know, there's because of the NWA, the security issues, you know, we had certain things in place so they could only take it in school. And now we've got to, you know, kind of unravel some of those things. Because, you know, we raveled them when kids were in session to make sure that everything worked right and was secure and all that good stuff. So it looks like you put this in there, though, so I think you have some thoughts about this as well.
I did. I worried a little bit about test security. We've seen heard anecdotal evidence of parents sitting next to their student while they take the test. We're finding a lot of parents are sitting with their students, parents love their students very much.
So this is one of those differentiations that I always make. Parents don't have students, they have kids. So parents are sitting with their kids.
Well, see, and I think of it a little differently than perhaps. I think that the parent is primarily responsible for their kids' education, so I think they do have students because they teach them stuff too.
Okay, fight me on this one.
I think we'll it's just approaching at it from different perspectives.
Yeah.
But some teachers have reported that every now and then they see a finger enter into the camera range with that looks like a pointing finger.
You know, like pick that one.
Pick that one. And they're seeing some students are scoring in the, 210, 215 region in third grade. Higher than they average third grader. and they just finished second grade. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, or even, or scores that are even higher than that. And so, and a lot of this stuff is used for teacher evaluation. I know NWEA says, don't use our test for teacher evaluation. That's not what happens. So, if the kids score super high on their initial test and we go back to school and the kid takes their, some districts offer it three times a year. And the kid takes it in January and the kid takes it in June or May, and scores lower. Well, the teachers can't use those scores to say, showed growth, right? Because, there's going to be a negative incline if the parent is not sitting next to the test, reliability. So I just throw it out there as a thing to talk about that, how we are doing these things, and we're required to do these things, but maybe we're not doing things that are, maybe we are required to do things that aren't necessarily beneficial for everyone involved, but we can't. Yeah. Anyway, you have something about replicating the classroom.
Yeah. So I'm starting to hear a lot of, I've gotten some questions from some other technology people, and from some teachers from around as well that are asking about streaming their classroom as kids come back. Because right now, for a couple of different places, they have kids, some kids in class and some kids not in class. And so the question that is coming up is, how can you stream the classroom and that? And essentially what the question is, can we replicate the classroom online? And this goes back to the question of availability as well, right? We can have, so let's say we have 20% of the kids or 50% of the kids or 10% of the kids or whatever the number is. What about those other kids? And one of the concepts being posited is, well, the kids can attend, but they'll attend virtually. Just they won't be there physically, but they'll be at their house and it'll be streaming and do all of that. And the question really comes down to, is that what we should be doing? Or is this online distance learning, what should it be like? Is that the, is that the answer? Or is there another answer? And are we having these discussions as well? Because I think those would be interesting instructional discussions to have in terms of what is best for kids. And that kind of leads to, you know, the learning process. We've learned a lot about learning and what learning does. And learning has changed. And I you know, I like to give the example of, you know, fixing a washer, which I have had the pleasure of doing a couple of times over the last few years. And the process is very different now than it was 20 years ago when I also fixed washers. I don't know what it is with washers, but, you know, stoves the same way. I've fixed several stoves as well. Anyway, and so what I used to do is you'd pull out all the tools that you have and you'd start trying to figure out and troubleshoot what was going on, right? And you had to have a conceptual knowledge of how a washer worked or how electronics worked in general to do that troubleshooting, right? You'd check, is there electrical input? Okay, yes, there is. Well, then we'd go to, you know, circuit boards. Does it appear that this is going here? You'd, like for a washer, is it spinning? Well, let's check the motor to see if the motor is the motor getting a power feed? If not, then we'd back up to the circuit board. you know, just taking a look at the counterweights and, you know, the belts and seeing, you know, something obviously broken. And that was the process that I used to go through. Now I go to YouTube and I say, washer's doing this. And I generally get a video that says, well, this is a common problem or this is a problem. Here is what to look at. Here's the part that's probably the problem. You know, replace that. And so it's frequently, it's like, oh, okay. And then I look and then I go over to the washer and I say, oh, yep, that aligns. Oh, wait a minute. This part looks different. So maybe I search and I find another video that says, oh, by the way, you know, the next model up or the next year of this, they did this differently. And I replace the part and generally it works and away we go. I'm all good to go. So the learning process is different, right? I don't really need to have any of that actual background knowledge. I just need to watch the video and go, oh, okay, all right, that's the part, okay, and this is how you take it out and this is how you replace it, good, okay, we're good to go. And I think about that, and then I think about, like, the learning process for kids as well, and we know that we know a lot about learning, a lot of brain research that has come out. So we know about some of these things. And are we talking about and have we put in place what should be video learning? You know, where does video come into play? What is audio? What should be audio? What should be text? How do we get to depth of learning too? Just because I fixed the washer doesn't mean I understand how a washer works, which for the washer example is fine, right? I don't care. On one point, I don't care how the washer works. I want to be able to put clothes in the washer. I want the washer to do its thing, and I want clean clothes to come out of the washer. That's really all I care about, right? And I just don't want to have to spend $600 to get a new washer if I can spend $50 for the part that fixes the washer. So learning is different in different environments. But have we taken that? Because kids are learning. They're learning all kinds of things. But they're learning what they want to learn when they want to learn it. And as part of the schooling process, we should be teaching them what they need to know versus what they want to know, probably. What they need to know to be a good functional adult. And are we leveraging some of the power that we have? Are we leveraging video? Are we leveraging audio? Are we leveraging text thoughtfully? So that instead of saying, okay, you're going to be here for an hour, because good teachers break that hour up anyway, right? They break it up into different sections, and you know, you have your introductory set and all those good lesson plan things. But are we, when we do things online, we could switch it up even more, and we could identify what we want kids to do and let them do that and block them in, put those things in blocks and have it work out so that kids learn things, they just learn in a different way. That's a rambling thought discussion as well.
Yeah, and so it actually touches on something that I've been thinking about in Moodle. I just need more time to play with it. So, you know the restrict access feature in Moodle?
Yes, right? I do. I love the restrict access feature in Moodle.
I do too. So what if you did a form of a choice board, right, where you give the students four choices? You can pick A, B, C, or D, right? And once they complete one of those choices, then another set of four choices open up. Mm-hmm. And another set of four choices open up, right? And they can pick, you know, and they can be divergent to the whole thing. Or what you could say is, you know, what you choose for choice A is going to depend on what kind of options you have for choice B.
Right.
Or, I mean, round two, you know. I didn't do that well. That's first round, four choices. But whatever you pick for the first one. So let's say you pick a verbal linguistic for the first round. You know, maybe the verbal linguistic is not an option in round two, therefore requiring you to think or use some sort of other modality or some other different way of thinking to demonstrate knowledge in that next round, forcing you to change and adapt and grow and that sort of thing. But at least somewhere along the line, there's something that you are initially comfortable with, mm-hmm. and then produce a product at the end. I don't know. So I've been playing with that idea, kicking it around, and you touched on it, so I thought I'd mention it.
No. And there's a lot of conditionals that you can do. It's like, if you already know this, maybe you don't have to do this so much. Just show me that you know it, and then we'll move on, and you can move on. And that does take a lot of work, and that would take a lot of thinking, because that's not how we tend to do education at this point, right? We tend to do much more lockstep education. It's much more difficult to address the personalization, which I shouldn't use that word, because that means something. It has a different connotation than what I really want it to have. But to adjust that learning to what kids need and want, because some of the lockstep, I think, is important. There has to be some some basis that everybody's that most people are good with.
So here's a question then I don't know the answer to. That's why I ask. Is there a way to restrict access so that when they take the pretest, if they score above a certain point, they get funneled into the same content but higher thinking level stuff? And then if you don't do well on the pretest, it forces you into a much more scaffolded, supportive set of...
Yep.
So if that's the case, then that would be a wonderful thing to put together and demonstrate as a way of saying, look, here's how this is better than Google Classroom or some other things that we could do online. I mean, this is a great way to differentiate, but it's going to require time and it's going to require effort, and we don't give our teachers time to put in that effort simply because we're building the plane as we fly it. I mean, that's not a criticism. That's just a fact of life.
Right. And here's the thing. There's a lot of commercial technology things that are trying to do some of that, but it is so, it's so limited, and they're pitching that as the answer instead of part of the answer.
Right.
That it ends up not working well at all. This I think needs to be part of the answer. That's why I say some of the in-step learning practices need to be in place. And the learning that is heavily differentiated needs to be part of that. Because there is some social aspects to learning as well. And I think there's some community things that need to be in place as well. And it's really, really difficult to, I believe it's really, really difficult to do that well on a global level, because I think that's where a teacher and those relationships and knowledge of the kid and the kid's background is so valuable as well. So anyway, it's just one of those things I've been thinking about. I've been thinking about the learning process and Jiminy Crickets. Could we use video more effectively? Could we identify what it is that kids really need to learn, break that up into chunks, knowing where they're coming from too, because background knowledge is huge, so that you know what they need to know and how to get them there. And then learning. All right. So where do you leverage video? Where do you leverage audio? Where do you leverage text? I was talking to actually my kid who's doing a conference, and I love her to death, and she has very very passionate thoughts. And as part of the conference, they were doing this thing where they watched the video on their own. And then they had a discussion, and she was like, I don't like that. And I was like, well, tell me more about this, because I think that's a great pedagogy. And she said, well, I went to another conference where you watched the video together and you had a chat as the video was going on.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, I get that. And I can see where a lot of kids would prefer that. And I think that those are two ways of doing kind of the same thing. And I think different kids are going to react differently to both of those. And I don't think one's right and one's wrong. I think it's kids need to be exposed to both of those ways so they know which way they learn better, and they do that. And you as a teacher know which way most of your kids are learn better, or which ones need to have the conversation as the video's going, and which ones need the time to process. So they want to watch the video and then talk about it, kind of thing.
You split your focus too when you try to type as the video is going on. You're going to miss something. As a kid, a seventh grader, I know seventh graders in general generally don't tend to have a good think about something else while they're typing. I don't know anybody that really does, but... Mm-hmm. So I think, I don't know, I'd have a hard time doing it. I totally get it. I had a student last week say, can we listen to this together? And I was thinking, Well, that would create this weird cacophony of sound. I'm going to say no this time, but let me think about that. I was trying to figure out ways to make it happen. But so it's kind of like, it's almost the same thing what we used to do with conferences when you and I would present. When today's meet was still a thing, you could run a today's meet in the background. And as you presented, you could then flex and make your presentation more adaptable and apply it to the audience based on the questions and things, the responses you're getting in today's meet. You can't really do that with a video, but it's kind of like what you're doing with Google Meet now, though, when you teach.
But this is kind of a replication of what's done in the classroom, though, too, because you could stop the video and have the conversation, right? So,
right.
So, as you know, if the chat's going along, somebody asks questions like, whoa, wait a minute here. I click pause. Let's talk about these comments. And then blah, 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 blah. And because there are some people that need to say things out loud, whether it's on typing or, you know, auditorily out loud,
right.
That's how they process things. So they're constantly talking, even if it's not audible, loud enough for other people to hear. They're constantly talking as they do things. So watching the video that way and reacting to the typing, blah, 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 kind of works for them. They're doing the focus shifting. I don't know. I thought it was interesting.
I was thinking. No, go ahead.
And it's a different way of doing things, right? And that takes thoughtfulness. And that takes knowing your kids. And that takes planning. Because I think there probably is a lot of really good video out there, or teachers could create their video, but it can't be an hour-long lecture for everything. You know, there's some things where an hour-long lecture is fine, but generally, you know, you shouldn't have everything be an hour-long lecture. But could you do that where identify those things, and would that make the learning more powerful for kids? So. All right, and so we did talk about some books. You're doing a book study right now.
I am.
And I have to tell you, I find this part fascinating as well, that we're talking about a book study, which there's a lot of online resources. So when we say book study, that's coming from I won't throw you in this one. That's coming from my past history, where we had a book study, you had a physical book. Well, maybe you don't have to have a physical book. Maybe a book study could really be an online resource study. So maybe it should really be a resource study versus a book study. But there is power in a book, too.
So here's a question for you. What would be the best way to curate those URLs for that resource study? You know, what kind of tool would you use to curate URLs for that?
So honestly, I think that would be one thing that an LMS could do really well. And I think Moodle could do that. You could create those resources right within there. You could have them organized. That would be fine.
One location.
And you could have a variety of things. Quite honestly, it depends on how deep you want to go with this. If you're just talking about links, then there's a whole bunch of different ways you could do it. I mean, you could just do a web page with different links.
One good way to curate, though, you know, where everybody could like dump into one location and share all those links into one place. This is called the setup. You can knock this one out of the park now.
No.
He has a favorite thing. He has a favorite one he uses.
Oh, okay. Now I get it. a little slow this morning. So if you're collecting links, hypothesis is the way to do that.
Because
then you could annotate and you could have conversations on those links as well. And you can actually implement hypothesis within Moodle and get a twofer there. But anyway, you were doing a book study. Thank you.
Yes.
Even the best hitters strike out every once in a while. And wow, did I strike out on that one. So you're doing The Perfect Blend by Michelle Eaton right now?
Yep.
And you're... Yeah. And so I've added that to my potential list, my books to read book list. So, and I don't know if you want to talk about that or not, but
sure, I can talk about it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Perfect Blends by Michelle Eaton. It's an SD published book. It's published this year, and it's got some nice. Well, so there's a couple of interesting things that I've taken away from it. I'm not going to talk about everything. And I've been through the first four chapters. I've got 5 through 8 I'm going to do for next week, book study meet, whatever. But I think it's interesting that she takes on Hattie's work on effective pedagogy. And she says, well, here's the flaws in Hattie's work when it comes to looking at the effectiveness of online learning. And I think she reinforces something that we've talked about in the past, saying, you know, people are doing, quote unquote, online learning. But are we really doing it well enough that we can say this is an effective tool? Or are we just kind of doing it because we're doing it in the moment? Is this truly effective? Is this truly good examples of good pedagogy online? And if we don't do it well, what kind of damage are we going to be doing to this area of study going forward in the future? And she kind of takes that on and says, look, we haven't done it well. And we've not really researched either to know what well is or what good is. So she takes on John Hattie's work and says, we really can't look at these coefficients that he's put together and say, well, you know, I can apply this here and apply this. See, look, all the bad things that happen in online learning. And then she goes on to say, no, so here's the ways we can take his work. And we can say, all right, so we know these things work. Well, here's how we could do this online when we're in an online situation. But then let's take it even farther. Let's look at good pedagogy. And so I'm at the point now where we're getting into what the good pedagogy might look like. And actually, I threw in a link that is in her book. I threw a link in the show notes here that we'll talk about later as one of the tools. I've not played with it a whole lot, but it really does replicate a lot of things that you and I would do in the classroom anyway. It just gives us a chance to say, we know this is good pedagogy in the classroom. Now I can translate it here to my online classroom. And then when I go back to my classroom, I can still use this in my classroom to, you know, as part of my good pedagogy. It's just, it'll be up on the screen instead of, you know, on my wrist or, you know, on a different location. And it's visible for all the kids to see, or I could actually push it out to their laptops if they're working in the classroom on something. So far, I like the book. We've been through the rationale for doing blended learning. Now, this isn't like totally going online. This is you know, online. This is forward thinking as to when we come back from online teaching. Do we now say, okay, turn in all your Chromebooks. Let's go back to pencil paper the way we were. And she says, no, it's not about that. It's about taking what we know is good online pedagogy and good in-classroom pedagogy and making those two blend. And what it looks in a perfect situation depends on your classroom and your kids. It's totally different from what it might look in a different classroom and a different set of kids. And you kind of have to read the room and you have to tailor in the tech and tailor the online or in classroom to where your kids are and what they need.
And I think another consideration is not only good online pedagogy and good online and good in-person pedagogy, but it is at this point student learning and, you know, what are they doing and how are they doing it already and how can we bring that in the classroom to help combine with those pedagogies? So, so there's a couple of other ones we have listed here. The Distance Learning Playbook, grades K through 12, is one that I think I'm going to be reading as part of a group coming up here. And then there is Best Practices for Teaching with Emerging Technology. And this one I thought was pretty fascinating because this is... this is by Michelle Pankanowski Brock. But one of the things that she's done is she worked with her publisher, and they have released 50% of each chapter with an open CC BY NC license. So Creative Commons attribution and non-commercial, so you can't sell it. But I just find it fascinating that there's 50% of the each chapter is available online. I haven't read it yet, but I think it's interesting that it's an interesting concept. What does 50% get you enough? Is it just 50% so you want to buy the book and it's kind of a taste of it, or what? So I thought that was interesting. And again, I don't know how I haven't read the book, but it is something that could be very valuable. And then there is also Remote Learning Online by Matt Miller. This is not a textbook, but this is an online experience, and this is free as well. When you register, they will ask you to agree to terms of service, and they will ask you to, but you do not have to tick the tick box to say, send me stuff. So you can leave that unchecked if you want, or you can let them send you stuff. But is this one that you did? I remember you talking about one that you were doing, and I don't remember if this is the one that you were doing or not.
Ditch That Textbook?
Yes.
Matt Miller? There's a couple of them. I don't think it was this one, but Matt Miller is pretty prolific, and he also has, he's been doing I can't remember the pirate guy. Dave Burgess is, so Dave Burgess started his own publishing house, right? And Matt Miller has kind of done the same thing. He's got a bunch of people writing these Ditch That textbook based, books. And they're of the same level and genre that Dave Burgess is. And who knows, he might be a branch of Dave Burgess. I don't know. There's been a lot of them. A lot of Matt Miller stuff. I like Richard, and I don't know how to say his last name. It's CZYZ. And I know he goes through the Ditch That Textbook publishing label. And I really like his stuff. But a lot of it's really good common sense, use this right now in your classroom stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
So, but I thought that was interesting, and I thought it was interesting. And again, one of the things as we were talking about, it's like, you know, we're doing book studies, and it's like, should we update the book study to a resource study? Because like the Matt Miller, there are 14 modules, and it's basically video-based and lecture, I believe. Again, I haven't been through all of it yet, but... So there's... I don't have to read the book. I can follow through the course curriculum and kind of do what we're asking the kids to do as well. So I think that's pretty cool. All right. And if you have suggestions of things that you like, please join the Hypothesis group and go ahead and bookmark them for me, which would allow me to be extremely lazy, which I always appreciate. Or send us an email. You can go over to middleschoolmatters.com and pick up the email address there. We'd love to hear from you about that. The other place that we love to hear from is the Twitterverse.
Oh, yes, Tammy McLean at T McLean 903. Learn how to create Google Meet breakout rooms for differentiated learning. And this has got some interesting ideas. Yeah, here we go. And it's also part of the Ditch That Textbook house. Let's call it a house for now anyway. And she's got some good suggestions in there. For creating breakout rooms, essentially what you're doing is you're pre-creating Google Meet Rooms. But she's got some very creative graphics to help say, all right, you go in this room and you go in this room. And the doors, she took images of doors and said, all right, and, you know, giving the kids the whole impression of you're in a room and you're going to do this in a room. And the way we've done it, at least through the tech coaches have taught us, is you create all of those and you invite yourself and you can be in all of those at the same time. And so you have, so I don't know if it's a Brady Bunch board, excuse me, or like one of those screens that you see in like a security officer's office, you know, at the mall where they got the big panel and there's like 30 different little windows on there. And you're like, how can you watch all of those at the same time? But that's essentially what you're creating. And then, and I tested mine with my students last week or yesterday on Friday. And, you know, and I, one by one, I went to each room and I talked to each set of kids that I'd put in the room. And they're like, okay. And I left the camera on so they could see me going from room to room and talking to each one to understand how this whole thing worked, right? And the chat part is incredibly small to read. Mm-hmm. And if you open it, it kind of obliterates all the pictures of the kids that are in the room. But it's functional. It works, especially as an alternative for, you know, some sort of other expensive software that you'd have to have. So I like the graphics that she used in here. It says choose a workroom. But of course, if you're doing testing, you would say I assign them a workroom or something. But she labels it and she's looking at it differently. She's saying this is a teacher help room. This is the open group room. This is the quiet group room. And this is the quiet room, the individual room. And you can go into all those individual different places and give the kids a choice as to how they want to work. And so the kids don't have to sit and listen to all the other kids chatterbox or ask a bunch of questions. Because I've had students say, can I leave the room so I can go focus on this without any noise? And I've been saying, yeah, go ahead, work on it and come back. I'll see you back at such and such a time. And they've been good about coming back. I know there are some kids that will, like if I, my kids last year would have said, okay, yeah, I'll be back at that time. But this is one way of saying, look, I can still monitor you and I can still give you selected help and I can still give you. So if you're in the quiet room, individual, leave me alone. I want to work. You could jump to the teacher help room and say, okay, now I got a question. Mm-hmm. Or the open group room or the, you know, quiet, you could jump back and forth between. Seventh graders, I could see it now be, you know, okay, now I'll do this. But you say, like, when you're in the room, you're in the room, except for the teacher help room. But I thought this was a creative way of saying, hey, you know, you make the choice in how you want to learn. I'm going to support you in the teacher help room. I'm going to monitor these other rooms, but you got a question. Come over here to this room, and I will work with you, right? So it's the same way as you were walking around the room and stopping at a student's table and saying, how can I help you right now? What do you need right now? So I thought that was a cool idea. And they give the steps, and I'm not going to go into the steps. There's a tab splitter, extension or plugin for Google Chrome, where you can just click on it and say, take this window, split it into four. And it equally gives you a nice four equal spaced for all of the OCD teachers out there. It gives you this nice four or six panel or whatever, how many panels you want for your screen. And it creates those rooms for you. Now, that being said, I have two computer screens going, right? And if I was going to do this, I'd have to put my main one on here or someplace and then put my four or six or whatever on the other one. And suddenly I find myself thinking, well, if nobody needs me and I could work on something, I really don't have a lot of space to do that and monitor all these things because it requires a visual monitoring. And so now I'm seeing that maybe I should be getting a third
screen
monitor. Mm-hmm. Yeah, third screen. Or get one of those really nice ones that you sent me the image of saying I should buy because it counts as two. I could just, you know, jump right through. But a lot of teachers are saying, I want a third monitor. I want a third monitor. And the one at work, I set it up as a three monitor setup for survival, not because I'm trying to impress anybody technologically. And I think that maybe this is something that would really facilitate that. Anyway, that's heading down the rabbit trail on that one. if, you know, there are already people hitting up the tech director saying, hey, you got any leftover monitors just sitting around I could use? And of course, they're all being used. Steven Weber, chunking and instructional, chunking and instructional strategy that may be more important now than ever. And this is a YouTube video. And I think it's a good reminder. And we do need to chunk things, even though, because as we sit in front of the computer screen and we're thinking about things in our own mind, I think we forget sometimes the level of the kids that we have in front of us. I know I do, right? At the beginning of the year, it hits me every year. I always go, oh, yeah, I'm teaching seventh grade. All summer I've spent, you know, lived inside my head and thinking, oh, yeah, we could do this. And, oh, yeah, we could do that. And that first, so just as a reminder, right, chunking. And then, of course, would you call it micro chunking or further chunking, you know, for kids who need that additional support, which goes back to that thing I talked about earlier. That's why I've been thinking about it. Mm-hmm. Christine Dixon, here's six of, whoops, here we go. Here's number six of at Teach Seuss and my STEAM challenges. So I put a link in there, and what it is a, oh, I'm sorry, this one is teaching about our national parks. So I know there's a lot of STEAM teachers out there looking for resources, and this one happened to jump across my screen and Twitter feed, and I thought, oh, this would be good for them. So this is a link to a national park site, which incorporates a lot of STEAM learning activities and lessons that STEAM teachers can just pull out and use and or design in their own way. And I thought, you know, if you're a STEAM person looking for something to heat up your steam, I'm looking for a really good way to metaphor it, and I can't do it. you know, this one might be Yosemite. Pick the one on Yosemite. That'll really get you steamed.
Yeah. Yes.
So,
Old Faithfully.
Ah, there you go. Okay, there we go. There we go. That's what we needed right there. Crystal Len, Ed, Doctor of Education, with a minus C, not a C minus, at Krista underscore Le. Educators, download our free starter set of interactive slides designed to facilitate social-emotional learning through connection and collaboration in your classroom, which I know is a big emphasis with a lot of administrators saying, we need to support SEL. And, of course, a lot of us teachers are scrambling for SEL ideas. And so here's one. Here's the catch, though. You do have to surrender your email address for their newsletter and some other things. But in doing so, they will trade that information for their free starter kit of interactive slides designed to facilitate SEL. So in case you want it, there it is. Joanne Freeman, I got the biggest kick out of her. She's an historian and has written several books that are I found fascinating. I throw this in there because you may be able to use this in your class, in advisory or somewhere. And all she says is, we've already jumped a shark. So many sharks. A sea of sharks. Stop. So here's what she's talking about. It's a link to a video. So in Japan, of course, flying robots are a big thing, right? Mm-hmm. You know, 1970s, 80s television, it was Johnny Sacco and his flying robot, or, you know, any sort of flying robot, you know, defending and saving humanity. So a company, a toy company, ironically enough, has spent, I think, $24 million so far on this robot. It's a Gundam robot, just like the TV show. And there's a video, CNN has a video of it, and you can watch the robot step off the gantry, take a knee, stand up, raise its hand, watch its fingers open and close. There's a bunch of other things too. So, yes, it is another robot video. This time it's 60 feet tall.
Wow.
Yung Xiao, PhD. In 15 minutes, which I'm going to have to tell you right now, that 15 minutes was a long time ago. By the time you're listening to this, watch Silver Lining for Learning, which of course they keep their videos and publish them. So more, this is more about that. MOOCs and open education in Southeast Asia. New models, fresh ideas, untold hope. Guests from Southeast Asia, hosted by @travelmindman, @Chris_DD, @PunyMarisha, @McLeod, which of course is Scott McLeod. and a number of others in that list. And there's a YouTube link, and so you can go back and watch that. So they've been doing it. I had an interesting conversation with a teacher in China on Thursday. On Tuesday, she said, "Can we see your school?" And she's talking about her and her daughter. And I said, "Well, I'm not at school right now." She goes, "Oh," I said, "but I'll be at school on Thursday. Let's set up a time to do that." Mm-hmm. So right at this exact time, she called on an Old Faithful called WeChat, and I walked her around the building. I wore her as, kind of like a big Flavor Flav clock on my chest, but I was carrying a cell phone. And we walked through, and, she goes, "Well, is this the office?" "Yep, this is the office." We walked into the lunchroom, and she goes, "Is this the canteen?" "Yeah, sure, this is the canteen." So got a few English words in there. She can tell she studied British English. Showed her the gym. "Oh, basketball." "Yeah," I said, "kids play here, and we do some other things." And did a tour of the building really quick. But at the end, one of the things she said was, Hannah, her daughter, was in this distance learning thing for 9 months. And she says, "You guys are doing things so differently than we did them." And we had an interesting conversation about the differences between the way teachers are doing distance learning in the U.S. and the way things are being done in Asia, that they really aren't comparative between the two. And she said, "I wish we'd have done it the way you had done it, or you are doing it right now," which I thought was also interesting. So that's a conversation for a different day. It was very encouraging because if her daughter had to go to a distance learning, online learning situation, she would prefer that she attended a school like the one we were doing as opposed to what her school was doing. So the daughter said, "Do you have a headmaster?" I said, "Yeah, we have a headmaster here at school." And she says, "Oh, I'm afraid of the headmaster. Don't want to be sent to the headmaster's office." I said, "Well, here, just hang on a minute." So I walked down the hall and walked to the principal's office, and I said, "Hey, can I borrow you for 2 minutes?" And he was very kind. And I introduced. So this is Mr. Fish, our administrator. And she was like, "Oh, I'm a teacher in China." And Annette, her daughter, sitting right next to her. And she says, "What do you teach?" And he goes, "Oh, no." He says, "I'm the headmaster." Mm-hmm. And I didn't see it, but he told me that immediately the seventh grader went whoop out of the picture, like, "I'm out of here." It was a fun way, because you have to remember that it was a fun way to remember that seventh graders are seventh graders. And I'm digressing here, but I think if there are things being done in Southeast Asia, we can take and we can pick the things that we think work well and are good pedagogy, and we can leave the things that aren't and use those to help us when we're doing our own teaching, whether it be in classroom, hybrid, or fully online. So don't forget, hashtag MS Chat every Thursday at 8 p.m. Todd Block will have a middle school topic all ready to go for copious conversations. Make this a strategic part of your professional learning.
Yeah, and we've talked about a lot of different things today. We have some resources for you as well. And mostly, you've done most of the resources this time. I was doing more thinking.
Well, I should stop that.
That's all right. you have a pencil lesson.
I do. I thought this was a pretty good lesson. So the Foundation for Economic Education produces a lot of really good stuff. And they posted online that they have their iPencil lesson, in Michigan, it's a seventh grade standard. The whole lesson right there is just all one. You can hit the entire standard just with that one lesson. And so they posted the video and the lesson plans and how to teach it in an online situation, online for you to use. It's all there ready to go. They don't have the standards correlated to it because they're thinking nationally, internationally. But I'm telling you right now, if you're in the state of Michigan, it fits. And I'm sure if it fits for us, it'll fit for you as well. So I wanted to throw that in there. It's a wonderful little lesson talking about all of a sudden the words are gone. It's supply, basically. There's no one person. Interdependence, that's the word I was looking for. It's a great lesson on interdependence and specialization, which are both two economic concepts which are taught in seventh grade Civ. So, and then there's Trevor Muir. It's geographically speaking, Trevor Muir is also in Michigan. And he has this course, his site is called the Epic Classroom, and he's doing a free webinar tomorrow evening, and you can sign up for it. And it's about virtual meetings and holding virtual meetings and some strategies you can use in your virtual meetings to really respond or help kids respond and connect with students in those meetings. It's free. Not all of his stuff is. Some of it is paid, and rightfully so. He produces pretty good stuff. And so I throw it out there as a free way for you to get some, get an hour or two of PD on Sunday evening. See the link to register for it. It, like I said, it's free. It doesn't cost anything, you know. And of course, he living in the southern peninsula of Michigan, he would be a troll, not a youper.
That's right. There is a Spot the Troll, which is kind of interesting. It is helps the kids look at a social media account and decide if it's authentic or not. And then they give you, so you go through it. It's just an interactive, it's an interactive tool to discuss and have the kids check themselves and see if they can design, if they can figure out which one is a troll and which one is a real person kind of thing.
Cool.
And one of the things that we know from learning is we need to kind of inoculate kids and others by giving them access to some of the fake stuff so that they can do better at identifying fake stuff in the future. So it's one of those tools to do that. So, but you might want to screen your classroom for that.
Oh, yes. You could use a resource called Classroom Screen. This was actually a resource from Michelle Eaton in the book The Perfect Blend. It's an online tool that allows you to display the instructions for your lesson in a clear and visual way. You can choose from over 12 widgets to support your class activities and help students get to work. This is the one I was talking about. You could use both online and in the classroom. So this is a, like a bridge between the two. This is not a resource that it's just for online or just for the time that we're in right now. So I wanted to include that really quick.
Okay. And we've got some more links for you as well. We've got some things about selling the future of ed tech, which I thought was really interesting. We've got a discussion about, and I almost put this in advisory because I thought this was really interesting as well. I think it's something that teachers should process. It's how kids are, how teenagers are going viral on TikTok, like just overnight. And some of them are making real cash on that. Not all of them. There's a select few. But some of them are, and that's a reality. And that's where some of the kids look at that and go, I could do, oh, I could be that. And so it's very interesting in terms of who's becoming a viral star on TikTok. We've got a reference to the kids have left the candy store.
Mm-hmm. And that connects right in with what you're talking about with TikTok, about the kids having the kids, middle school kids and high school kids have the largest amount of disposable income. And so they get targeted, you know, through media and whatever. But so they've been watching where kids have been spending their money. And it's not the traditional books, candy and comic books. It's now turned into paying for webs or for web games on Roblox and doing, you know, paying for video stuff on YouTube indirectly, obviously, you know, through advertisements and whatever. But the second one there about the Roblox, kids are designing games in Roblox and other kids are paying them money for the games that they design in Roblox, which I thought was interesting.
And there's also building an oasis in the screen time desert as well.
Yep. So we'll put a link in there, a link to how to even short periods or breaks from screen time are we're seeing or the research here is showing that there's a very positive impact on family dynamics.
Mm-hmm. And you could have a positive impact on your professional dynamic by heading over to middleschoolmatters.com. There's links to everything that we've talked about and much more. Again, we would love it if you'd send us an email or do my job for me and contribute some hypothesis links as well. And of course, we would absolutely adore it if you'd head over to iTunes, give us a 5-star rating, and tell us why Sean is the world's greatest coach host. And again, all those links are available. And we now have a feature where you can sign up and get an email when there's a new post, which is usually once a week. But that way you don't miss it, and you can go right to the site and get all those links. Of course, you could set up your RSS feed reader to do the same thing, but you know we're here to serve. So without further ado, this has been Middle School Matters for middle school educators who care.